Listen, there's a lot of talk about love. We often hear people say things like, I love coffee, or I love Netflix. There's a lot of talk about love, and musicians keep pumping us with a steady stream of songs about love, and movie producers give us a steady supply of rom-coms dealing with the topic of love. They're all seeking to tell us something about love. And as we listen to what these people have to say, as we read the bumper stickers, what people love, what musicians tell us that they love, what movie makers tell us that love is, we soon come to realize that a good definition of love is hard to come by. Defining what love is can be a bit fiddly if all we're listening to are cultural voices about love. And so it's no surprise that not a few people who have looked to find out what love is have turned to the Bible to hear a true and good and beautiful word spoken about love. Something more tangible, something more meaningful than what our rom-coms and our musicians are offering us. And so when people turn to the Bible, they find great definitions and descriptions of love like this: love is patient. Love is kind. Love does not envy or boast, nor is it arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. We've come to trust the Bible with descriptions of love. Even those who do not believe in Jesus yet are happy to have a description like this, perhaps quoted at a wedding, because we've come to trust that the Bible has something good and true and meaningful to say about love. And if so, if we're willing to trust the Bible with these kinds of insights about love, what I'm asking us to do this morning is turn to another passage in the Bible that will teach us about love. And my hope in doing this is that we'll grow in our understanding of what love is and how we are supposed to understand love as God would have us understand it. I'm going to read for us now from 1 John chapter 4, another passage dealing with love. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is from God, and whoever loves has been born of God and knows God. Anyone who does not love does not know God, because God is love. In this, the love of God was made manifest among us, that God sent his only Son into the world so that we might live through him. In this is love, not that we have loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God. If we love one another, God abides in us, and his love is perfected in us. As we look to grow our understanding of love from this passage, the first insight that might help us is to know that this passage, this book that we've been working through, 1 John, has been written by a man that was nicknamed the Apostle of Love. Now, I'm no genius, but if you wanted to find out something about love, starting with a man that was nicknamed the Apostle of Love is not a bad place to start. He was known for his understanding and appreciation for love. So we start at a good place. And this Apostle of Love begins by writing to a church community, people like you and I who gather to follow Jesus through the scriptures. That much is obvious when we look at the word beloved. It was just a common word of endearment, a common word of affection amongst Christians in those early days. They would regard each other as the beloved. They would think of each other as the beloved. And what the apostle of love would have the beloved do is to love one another. That's what he's interested in for their church community, that they might love one another. Now I ask, why is a simple and yet specific instruction like this important for a church community? If you were leading a group of followers of Jesus into what it means to follow Jesus, how to live the Christian life, why start or why bring up this simple yet basic instruction over and over again? Love one another. Why go back there? Why do basics? Why say something so obvious? I think it's so because, not because this apostle of love has this excess ink and he has a word count to fill up before he can get his book in the Bible. It's because he wants us to think deeply about loving one another. And the moment we do, the moment we start thinking about what it takes to love one another, we begin to weed up and expose some of our disinclinations towards loving one another. We start to become aware of reasons why I don't want to be loving towards another person. For instance, it's pretty easy to love those we have chosen to love, right? It's easy to love a friend that you really like. It's easy to love a husband or a wife that you really enjoy and that you have chosen to love. It's easy to say, yeah, John, I'll love one another as long as I can pick who I love. And that's precisely the apostle's point, isn't it? That he doesn't just say, love those that you are naturally inclined to love or that you choose to love. He says, love one another. Even the people that you did not choose in your Christian community. Love everybody in your Bible, gospel, Christian community. Love the people you go to church with, even the ones that you did not handpick to be there. Love the people that you wouldn't naturally gravitate toward. Love one another. All the people in your church community. Now, this may sound like a bit of hard work. When you look around, you're like, man, I'm just not naturally inclined to loving so-and-so. Sounds like hard work. And so you might be asking, where do I find the resources for that kind of love, right? For genuine love for another person that I'm not naturally gravitating towards. Where might we learn this radical kind of love in Christian community? Where could we turn to resource ourselves? And the Bible's answer is that we learn to love beyond our naturally selective boundaries by imitating God. We resource ourselves and we learn about this radical love by imitating God. I see this in our passage because the apostle of love has just told his readers to love one another, and then he moves into more foundational reasons for why they ought to love one another. Don't lose me here. He's just told us, he's just described for us the house of love, and then he digs down underneath that house and he says, this is the foundation that that house of love is built upon. And he shows us God. He shows us what holds that kind of love. What sustains that kind of love. Look at that at verse 7. He says to us, beloved, let us love one another. And then here comes his foundational reasoning. He says, let us love one another, for love is from God. That's the reason. And then you look a little bit further at verse 8, and he makes this radical statement. He says, here's a statement of fact. God is love. In other words, we learn to go beyond our naturally selective boundaries If we are to go beyond those naturally selective boundaries, we need to know something true and good about love as it relates to God. So what does the Apostle of Love teach us about love as it relates to God? Well, what I want you to notice is that in this passage, the writer moves from love, or God is love, being an abstract idea, just an idea, just a theory, or whatever you might think that that statement brings to mind. He moves from it being an abstract idea towards love having grounded, being grounded in real actions. So God is love. It's not just an idea that you're supposed to go, oh yeah, God is love, and that'll just float wonderfully over my life. You're supposed to think, what does it mean that God is love? What does that really look like in real terms? And now the Apostle of Love tells us what God is love looks like in real terms, real actions. And that will help us understand what is meant by a phrase like God is love. The first of these very real actions that we see about God is love is that God demonstrates his love, right? God's love is in action. We see this in verse 9. In this, the love of God was made manifest among us, that God sent his only Son into the world so that we might live through him. Look, at the very least, this verse tells us that love is more than a feeling. It is more than a sentiment. It's more than just a well wish. That genuine and true love will invariably be seen in action. It cannot help itself if it is true and genuine to display itself, to demonstrate itself, or to, as the passage says, to manifest itself, to make itself real. So at the very least, we learn that about love. But the way God manifested his love also introduces the idea that sometimes when love makes itself real, when love goes beyond naturally selective boundaries, love is going to be costly. Love is going to be costly. We see this in the phrase that God sent his only Son into the world. I want you to be on that word only. I write it in bold and I underline it because we want to spend some time on that. That's where the cost of God's love is emphasized by the writer. Let me give you a little illustration. Years ago, I worked in a pretty big warehouse that was for an online retailer. And sometimes if you walked around the back of this giant warehouse, these containers would just come in by the dozen, right, filled up with the same kind of product. And there'd just be containers upon containers of the same kind of stuff. And often, when they would unload these containers of the same item, and just a few would get written off the books, right? A sample of these new products would just vanish. A photographer needed them, someone else wanted to look at the quality of it, and they just disappear. Because there was so much of it, no one would ever notice. There was just so much of this one thing that nobody really cared that you just took one and it got written off. But God sending Jesus is very different. God did not have a warehouse stocked full of Jesuses where he could just take one and write him off the books with hardly any impact to his bottom line. There was an only Son. There is one Jesus. For the Father to send Jesus cost him everything that he had of Jesus. It was all of Jesus that he had to give. And I'm just groping for words here. I know the illustration probably is not doing all of this all that much justice. But in getting, I'm just getting us to think about God sending Jesus, his only Son, and how costly that would have been to send all of him, the only one of him, into the world that we might live through him. It was a costly love. And from this, we're meant to learn about what it takes to love one another, even those we would not naturally gravitate towards, right? That sometimes to love one another is going to cost us something. It's going to be personally costly. We're going to feel the impact of it. It's going to tax some of our resources, consume them, whether it's your time or your money or your physical or your emotional energy. It's going to cost to love one another. But we learn that from God, right? That God was willing to count the cost of love and provide us with this awesome example of costly love so that we might follow and imitate him. And not always calculate, oh, have I got the resources to love you? But to just count the cost and love. I'm not pretending this kind of love is going to be easy. Look, I'm not trying to tell you that, look, just walk into church and we'll just love, right? It'll just come so naturally to us. It's not. Just because you're a Christian doesn't mean that you are now automatically like grade A in your love supplies. We'll still find love hard. The Lord knows in the ways in which I struggle to cultivate love beyond my own naturally selective boundaries, right? They are just people that you're more naturally drawn towards, that it's easier to love than others. I think we all sense that. But there is one thing that will surely stunt us towards learning how to love one another that this passage highlights. There's something that will stunt us from making any progress towards cultivating this kind of love for one another. We will cut ourselves off at the knees if we say the following. If we say, you first. If you love me first, then I'll love you in return. That will destroy our ability to cultivate love for one another. You first, and then I'll love you in return. The late Christopher Hitchens said it this way. He used a little illustration just talking about this. He said, if I really love someone, right? If I really love someone who'd been sentenced to prison, if I could find a way of serving your sentence, I'd try and do it. Like, yeah, that's so loving, man. That's awesome. And then he says, I'm very unlikely to do this unless you've been incredibly sweet to me. Right? Yeah, man. I'll do your prison sentence. I'll love you like that. But I'll only do it if you've been incredibly sweet to me. We think that way, right? You first. You love me first, and then I'll show some in return. He's just saying what we all gravitate towards. I'm not trying to pick on him or anything. He's just saying what we all feel. We think that there's no way that we're going to be taking that first step towards love unless you've taken that step first. Now, the apostle of love, he anticipates this kind of response in our hearts, right? This you first kind of love. So he directs us to this fact. If we as followers of Jesus are learning to love from God, If we are going straight to God as the fountainhead, our great teacher for what love is, if we are truly learning from Him, He will show us that He did not say you first before He loved us. God did not sit in the heavens and say, oh, there's all these people, I'll wait for them to love me before I love them. You first. And we'll see how that plays out. That's not what God did. Verse 10, have a look at this. It says, and this is love, not that we have loved God, but that He loved us. See how God did not first wait on us to love Him before He loved us? He's teaching us not to fall into that trap of saying, look, I will only love you if you love first. He initiates. He takes the first step. He loves first, and we're supposed to learn from Him that we too, His people, are now free to love first. We don't have to wait on others to love us first before we love them. We can be the initiators of love and community. The writer makes this very point. We, the believing community, are meant to learn love by considering how God loved. That God manifested His love, made it evident, put it on display, made us aware that it was costly love, and then moved toward us in that costly love before we did anything good toward Him. Right? Beloved, if God so loved us, if that's the way that God has loved us, you also ought to love one another. Listen, let me bring this to a close with some application for us as a church. I have two applications in mind. The first one might sting a little bit. Firstly, I know how easy it can be to excuse ourselves from obedience to love one another. It's easy to think that, look, that may, doesn't fully apply to me. There's other commands that I will focus on. There's other things that I like about Christianity that I will focus on. We don't get to pick and choose that way. But we make excuses from loving one another. And one of the primary ways in which we excuse ourselves from loving one another is through erratic church attendance. I'll just say it like it is. You know, medical reasons withstanding, we cannot love one another if we do not prioritize being with one another. I mean, that's just common sense, right? I can't love you if I'm never with you. Not really. Not genuinely. So all I want you to know this morning is that if you're skimping on church, you're skimping on love for one another. You're skimping on the very thing that we're supposed to be doing as Christians. And if you want to grow in this love, and I hope you do as a follower of Jesus, if you want to grow in this love for the whole church community, for one another, for all of your church community, right? You've got to start by being regular among your church community. You've got to be there to love them. My second application about love for one another are for those who have grown cynical about love. We are in a cynical culture. I read an article yesterday that says, did the Simpsons ruin a generation? The subtext was, we have all grown cynical about life. We are cynical people. Because we've seen it for so long that cynicism is how we're supposed to approach life. So if you're cynical about love, you come to a text like this and you hear Christians talk about love, you see the words written in the Bible, but there's this little voice in the back of your head yapping away that says something like a BB Rexha song. My heart's been hurt a couple of times by a couple of guys that didn't treat me right. Ain't gonna lie, because I'm tired of the fake love. I'm tired of the fake love. That's the voice in the back of your head. The invitation in this passage is for you to give authentic community of Jesus followers a try. The passage would invite you to that, to take a risk and to try an authentic community of Jesus followers into love. To learn with them, to make mistakes with them, but to at least begin the process of cultivating real love, because we are all people who want to find real love, and we really want to learn how to love one another, and we're going to make mistakes along the way. And for those mistake making moments, we do have times where we will say sorry to one another, and we will invite and receive forgiveness from one another. But together we continue on, even though mistakes and love will be made here. We continue on because the one to whom we belong and the one we follow, Jesus, he makes no mistakes in his love. And he never ever offers fake love. In time, this Jesus, his forgiveness earning love, may even conquer your cynicisms about love.